Good evening, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Ann W. Smith, co-chair of the Club's Arts Forum, and your chair for today. We also welcome our listeners on the radio. And we invite our audiences to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it is my pleasure and delight, in fact, to introduce Dr. Jay Hsu, who is director of the Asian Art Museum. He has been at the museum for almost 2 years, yes, appointed in 2008, and has brought great new energy to museum life in San Francisco. And right now they're in the middle of this the Shanghai exhibition, which is one of the largest of this particular city celebration events, because Shanghai is sister city of San Francisco. This is the catalog, this gigantic book, and there'll be a copy. You can have a look at it afterwards. Before arriving at the Asian Art Museum, Jay has had rich and varied museum experiences. He's been the chairman of the Department of Asian and Ancient Art, Asian and Ancient Art, and head of the Department of Asian Art at the Art Institute of Chicago, curator of Chinese art at the Seattle Art Museum, and fellow at in the Department of Asian Art at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. So he's had a lot of experience here in the States. And he's a naturalized American citizen who came here a few years ago.
20 years ago.
And there's room up front here. And is a really engaging speaker. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce and welcome, with great pleasure, Jay Hsu.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Anne and Ling. And I'm really, truly honored and humbled to be here presenting a conversation with you about Shanghai. When I walk into the door of Commonwealth Club and saw the august speakers in this very important organization, which has celebrated centennial, I was really feeling very nervous. Because, as you know, I came to San Francisco 2 years ago as a new practitioner in directing a museum. I've been on my job for 1 month shy of 2 years. I've been in the field of Asian art and a curator for 25 or so years, but had never been a museum director until 2 years ago. So in this very prominent organization to present a talk is truly a very steep challenge for me, but Ling and Anne want some new voice, so I think I mustered the courage and to offer myself to you, and I cannot guarantee that how you will like it, but I will follow in the spirit of the founding members of this club, that we only propose to find the truth and let it loose in the world. So in the spirit of finding the truth, I can offer the best I've got. I cannot guarantee you what I'm going to say about Shanghai will be universal truth or objective truth, but I can guarantee you it will be my own personal individualistic truth. And how you make of it is up to you. So, you know, the part of my title for the talk is Understanding the Power of Art and the Visual Culture. So let me just dwell on a moment about the power of visual culture. I think I cannot say enough how powerful it is, because we live our life on a daily basis, making new acquaintances. Actually, we judge people by first impression, what people wear, and how they carry themselves in the manners. All these are visual. You basically be able to size somebody up within the first 1 minute of an encounter. Person walking at you from a distance, so you basically have an impression. And this first impression is visual and very important. And also, talking about urban center, the world that we live in, whether it's a village or cities or urban centers like San Francisco or Shanghai, one big part of the impression that we talk about and leave with us when we go to another city, having visited a city, is that it's an urban landscape, it's urban architecture, and that's very visual as well. So I think the power of visual culture is extremely important. We live it on a daily basis. We may not be always acutely aware of how important that is, because we're overwhelmingly concentrating these days, for example, on the economical crisis of the world that we're living, which is absolutely important. But on the other hand, the visual culture is equally important, because this is we define who we are on an individual basis. It also defines what our cities is. In many ways, Shanghai is like that. So there's so many things people can talk about Shanghai, and actually there's so many books that have been written about Shanghai. It is almost paradoxical for me to talk about Shanghai, because I don't have any credibility to claim to be an expert on Shanghai, except I grew up there. And Shanghai has been part of my blood. And in my 20 or so years life in the United States, I go back to Shanghai every year for my work and for my family. So I do have a very personal level of understanding. And like all of you, I'm a voracious reader. So I try to read as much about Shanghai as I could. But on the other hand, I think the exciting thing about Shanghai is that there can always be one more book that can be written about it. There's always one more perspective that is possible. So my perspective today, and if there's one word, and one word only, that I'd like you to leave this lecture with, is the contradiction. I think Shanghai is a city full of contradictions, and it has been always like this, and it is today, and I can, in my own personal humble way, it's going to be like this, continuing. And actually, this very lecture is a contradiction. You know, as I said, I'm not a quote-unquote academic scholar on Shanghai, yet I'm here to talk about Shanghai. I've been known as an academic scholar on ancient China, not so much on modern China. On the other hand, you know, I'm presenting a talk on the visual culture and art of Shanghai, yet I have no pictures to show you. So I have to muster the power of words to conjure up images in your mind about Shanghai. And I think the word contradiction is a good one in terms of conjuring up certain sentiment, certain visual images that you may well. And also, I like to emphasize that the contradiction is something that is innately dynamic. And this is also what something defines Shanghai, what Shanghai is. Sense of imbalance, sense of evolving, sense of a struggle, sense of radicalism, sense of a rapid change as we are experiencing it today. So the impetus for today's talk and the kind of invitation from Anne and Ling is, of course, the Shanghai exhibition that we have in our museum. So let's talk about why we do the exhibition this year. Of course, Shanghai not only is the sister city of San Francisco, it's celebrating its 30th years of relationship. Shanghai and San Francisco were the first cities in China and the U.S. that established a sister-city relationship after normalization of Sino-U.S. relationships after 1972. But also, there's a timely impetus. That is, this year, Shanghai is home to the World Expo, which opened on May 1st, again, like Olympic Games, with great fanfare. And right now, it's continuing. Actually, I'm leaving for Shanghai to see the World Expo the day after tomorrow. So I may be able to email you, tell you how I feel about it. I always believe you have to see it before you make up your mind. So my verdict is out, I think there's great energy. That's for sure, with the expo. So that's the reason why we do the exhibition. But we also centered our exhibition around the Bay Area-wide Shanghai celebration. That's the initiative that our museum has taken about a year and a half ago, based on very simple understanding. we told ourselves the reason we do Shanghai this year is because of the World Expo, because of the close relationship between San Francisco and Shanghai. If we do a program on Shanghai, probably there are many organizations in the Bay Area who will do similar Shanghai-related programs, even though they may be on very different topics. In this climate of economic challenge, why don't we talk to each other, see if we can create a forum that cross-promote each other's programs? Sure enough, soon after I talked to a dozen also colleagues in different organizations, there is such a groundswell of enthusiasm. So based on some very simple understanding idea, a year and a half later, we have organized a Shanghai celebration across the Bay Area throughout the year of 2010 with more than 50 programs related to Shanghai. For example, the office club in the Presidio has just concluded their exhibition called The Jews in Modern China, with a big emphasis on Shanghai, because Shanghai was a major city of immigration and safe haven for Jewish refugees, for example. So there's other organizations doing a lot of projects related with Shanghai as well. So I'd encourage you to check the website called www.shanghaicelebration.com to check the all kinds of programs that are being presented in the Bay Area. Part of my ambition for our museum is that we serve as a platform to forge closer partnerships in the Bay Area, not only helping ourselves, but also helping fellow institutions. And in helping others, hopefully we get ourselves helped as well. So talking about Shanghai, let me start with my own background. It is also, again, a contradiction. You know, I indeed grew up in Shanghai, and in English, there's an expression called born and bred, right? I was born and bred in New York, for example. But I did not get to eat serious bread until I came to this country 20 years ago. So I would opt to make a small change. I say I was born and raised in Shanghai. We grew up eating rice, dry or congee. And I still love rice. I eat it on a daily basis, but as much as I eat bread these days. So my contradiction is that I have a strong affinity with Shanghai because I did not leave the city until I was 28 years old by going to Princeton for my doctoral training. So I left Shanghai really as an adult and also already in the museum profession. I had worked for the Shanghai Museum, the museum that I worked as my first job, already for 7 years before I went to Princeton. So I have a quite developed personality and a very personal understanding of what Shanghai meant to me as a, my hometown, as a place that I grew up. However, nowadays, I have a hard time considering myself as Shanghainese in a way, because the rapid change of Shanghai, both good and also something to me is fundamentally lost, is a sense of my hometown, actually. There's in the process of so much development, for example, the neighborhood that I grew up was literally physically obliterated, replaced by the high-rises, and which is by itself not necessarily a bad thing. Imagine the neighborhood I grew up, you know, the plumbing was an issue, electricity sometimes is an issue. To have the modern high-rises with all the amenities is absolutely an improvement. On the other hand, the neighborhood, the heritage, the tradition is also being compromised and sometimes at danger of being lost. And to me, you know, on my personal level, it is true. So I could not find my neighborhood anymore. You know, I go to Shanghai every year, but I don't really walk about. I really rely on taxi to take me to where I want to go because it's hard for me to find my way around. The city has just changing so much. So this is one contradiction, the balance between preservation and development. I think this is the contradiction Shanghai has to continue to grapple with on a daily basis, and there's a lot of opinions about this. I think this is wonderful in that sense. I think it's Shanghai is certainly probably most dynamic topic for debate. So, and because I come from background of traditional scholarship, ancient China is really my field. So let me quote what Confucius said. Confucius said the most important thing in life, the first thing you do is rectify the name. You know, the name is very, very important. You must make sure the name meets what it means, and the meaning or the substance of something has appropriate naming to go with it. So let's start with the name of Shanghai. You know, this, again, is a contradiction in some way, because Shanghai is both a verb as well as we know it's a noun. It's the name of city, so it's a noun, right? But may I ask some of you, how many of you have recently been Shanghai'd? Is anyone? Well, I try to make a creative use of the verb. In this case, Shanghai'd, meaning you travel to Shanghai. But Shanghai'd, or Shanghai, the verb certainly has its historical meaning. I think about several years ago, I visited Portland in Oregon, and there's a district, there's a lot of bars and restaurants, and at one of which I somehow got a conversation with the bar owner. And as conversation went on, he said, "Let me show you something." So he opened a door on the floor, and there was a cellar. Actually, there was a tunnel all under. He says, "This is the trapping door." So when in those good old days, when people came in and we got them drunk, not himself, the people who run the bar a long time ago, and then the trapping door would open and people dropped. And next day when they woke up, they are on a boat to Shanghai because they need a really strong, muscular man as sailor to Shanghai and as part of the effort to trade, which comes up with a lot of a human cost to it. So Shanghai does not always have its good name. And in the 1930s, when Shanghai was really a very glamorous city in the world, it was called as the Paris of the East, but also some people labeled it as the whore of the East because of the rowdiness of the city life, because of the very mixed quality of life that had been carrying on in the city of Shanghai. And why Shanghai would conjure up such a strong contradictory images, I think there are several reasons. And going back to the name, Shanghai is made up of two characters, Shang, or in Chinese pronunciation, Sang. It could both as a the adverb or as a verb. Adverb means above, up, and the verb could go up, if you will. And the key part of the city's name is Hai, which means sea, ocean. Okay, so from the very beginning, the Shanghai, you could say the mentality or the image you can draw up about this place is above the sea, up to the sea, or go up to the sea. And this is already defining the innate contradiction about Shanghai. Because throughout China's history, China was very much a continental country. You know, Shanghai has a Himalayas on the other, or China has a Himalayas on the other region. It says that on the east, there's oceans, there's seas, but it's very much, it's a land-based country. And it has a wonderful agriculture throughout much of its history, so it's very much a self-sustaining. It did have a lot of trade with overseas, but it was controlled. Not so much as a trade that would understand as both ways and a trade as the primary pillar of economy to shore up a nation. The land-based economy, land-based agriculture was the most important pillar to shore up the economy. So from very beginning, Shanghai was kind of odd because it's very much a city starting with a fishing village by the sea, up to the sea, and facing the outside sea. So that is making Shanghai very interesting. And also, Shanghai had a very traumatic beginning as the urban center. And at one point in the throughout much of the Ming Dynasty of China, which ends in the 17th century, there was actually an embargo of overseas trade. Chinese seaboard was closed for a long time. But that policy was reversed in the later 17th century, where Manchu conquered China and established the last dynasty that we call Qing Dynasty. The Emperor Kangxi, I think, if I remember correctly, in 1674, reversed the policy and opened up the overseas trade. And Shanghai was one of the major seaports to engage in this trade. But that trade was different, again, what we think of today. That was more about how the Chinese government could control, at that time the imperial government, control the trade very selectively with overseas. But once you start to open doors and make trade, all kinds of people came upon you, right? And one of which is the British Empire. They wanted to trade with China as well. And China has silk, tea, and porcelain. British really had relatively little to offer in return. But they had one thing, and they felt that's one thing that could have a very lucrative market. That's opium. That's opium. And so, but Chinese did not want to trade in that. And eventually that led to a war we called First Opium War. And China suffered a very humiliating defeat, First Opium War and the Second Opium War. As a consequence of the First Opium War, which was fought in 1840, Shanghai was one of the five cities that opened up for free trade, no restriction, free trade in China with the international world, particularly with the British in charge. So Shanghai started out at a very traumatic beginning. But beyond 1840 Opium War, less than 20 years later, China involved itself in a major civil war called the Taiping Rebellion. Many of you may not have heard of a Taiping Rebellion, but you'll be shocked to learn this civil war was bloodier, with more human being died than World War I. So it was one of the most bloody human conflicts in the world, and fought right there in the southern part of China, with Nanking being established as the capital of the Taiping Kingdom. And Shanghai literally became sort of an isolated island. It became a primary destination of refugees from neighboring regions. As I said earlier, that China had traditionally been based on agriculture, and the northern part of China was very well developed, first than the southern part of China. But in the later part of the imperial history, southern part of China became most affluent. So the largest concentration of wealth in China during the later imperial period, the Ming and the Qing dynasty, was in the provinces around Shanghai. And when the Taiping Rebellion broke out, most people went to Shanghai as refugees. The Shanghai became a safe haven. So these two very traumatic events really, in large measure, defined Shanghai's beginning, and in a contradictory way, made Shanghai the place with the largest concentration of not only domestic wealth, but also foreign traders and immigrants. That's the beginning of Shanghai. So if we think of Shanghai at that time, it being 1840 onwards to 1930s, Shanghai is not one city. Shanghai is two cities. Shanghai had both international settlements as part of the concession that the Imperial Chinese government conceded to British and Americans and the Germans, and that you needed to establish concessions and international settlements for free trade and for free settlements. On the other hand, as I mentioned, Shanghai had already developed from 17th century as a major trading port. So it's an old town with walls. And this is the part of Shanghai that was remained under the Chinese control after the First Opium War. So you have a very strong contrast between on the international settlement, French concession, very rapid infusion of immigrants from many different places, very rapid development of trade and all kinds of trading horses. And on the other hand, you have the old town, which is still very close tied to the traditional Chinese culture. So on the one hand, Shanghai became the frontier of experimentation with westernization. On the other hand, Shanghai also became a stronghold of the traditional values and traditional cultures. And because there's so many wealth concentrated there and brought in by many affluent people, families from neighboring regions, often the case carrying with them the art collections, Shanghai also has become the home to some of the most important art collections, which ultimately define what the collection of the famous Shanghai Museum is. So if you go to China today, probably go to Shanghai, you won't miss Shanghai Museum, one of the very best museums, not only in China, I dare to say, in Shanghai. And I was very proud to be associated with this. I started my work there, my career there, 25 years ago as a secretary to the museum's director. So I really learned trade in the front line, if you will. And but Shanghai Museum is unique in the sense it is almost one and only museum in China that is largely based on private collections. Rather than archaeological materials that most of the Chinese museum different parts are based on, or imperial collection, such as Forbidden City, the Palace Museum, and for that matter, the Palace Museum in Taiwan as well. They're both from the imperial collection, but Shanghai is very unique in that regard. So how does this relate and portray itself in the visual culture of it? And then the contrast and contradiction between the new town, the international settlements, and the old town cannot be stronger. You think of old town, you think of the garden, the famous Yu Garden, with artificial rocks, pond, zigzagging path, willow trees, lotus pond, and beautiful pavilions with beautifully shaped eave and so on and so forth, ancient music, tea house. And you think of the Newtown International settlements, if using 1930s, 20s as example, you think of Art Deco, right? Shanghai had actually one of the most important sites to study the style of Art Deco, and which invented in Europe, and particularly in France. But there's also crossovers. There's also interactions. So, for example, again, using Art Deco as an example, you think of Art Deco building, as well as think of Art Deco furniture, some of which you will see in our exhibition. They're not entirely French. They're not entirely the Shanghai imitation of what the latest fad in Paris was. Actually, there's a strong interaction between the traditional Chinese furniture motif with the French style. And you can see clearly with furniture on view, as well as the rugs, as well as the other buildings, and some of which that are still very well surviving in Shanghai. So I think this is important. So you do think of two worlds, and with values that may be innately, diametrically opposed to each other, but on the other hand, there's a conversation between the two. There's a contradiction, then there's interaction. So I think that is very important. And of course, the other way of for the most powerful manifestation of visual culture is the dress that we wear. And actually, most of us on the 1 minute level, we judge people or judge each other by what do we wear. And often the case, people comment on, you look like an academic. I wonder why? I think probably have something to do with how I dress myself. I certainly am not a surfer. You don't look at me thinking this is a wonderful surfer. This cannot be further from that, right? So I think the one very distinctive of a Shanghai dress, which you can also see in Shanghai, is called qipao. And if you talk to many Chinese ladies who grew up in the 30s or in Shanghai or had a former generation there, qipao is a name itself is a contradiction. Because qi literally is a name that Manchus call themselves. They called qilin, people of banners. Qi literally means banners because Manchus organized their society by different units, and they call those units as banners. So qipao is like a robe of the Manchus. But it could not be farther from truth. It was artificial invention, literally, in Shanghai. It's a mixture of the traditional long dress with a Western sensibility as well. It both have this long linear a part covering much of body, but also it has a part that really exposes the shapeliness of lady very well. Some qipao are so tight that I do not really know how to talk about this, but I understood some of them are so shapely, so tight that you would have hard times to sit down. And you can see some of them in our exhibition as well. So this contradiction between traditional value and in the forward-looking as well as controversial trends is very exciting. And I think the reason for being so is precisely because of nature under which Shanghai was born. Shanghai was not a typical city of China. From day one, it was atypical. It was a seaside city in a land in the continentally minded countries. It was a city that is very vibrant economically, but did not have depth of roots. Even its old town is considered, it was relatively new compared to Suzhou, for example, and other cities nearby. And it is a mixture of people. We think of Shanghai, the way I look at it, nowadays, looking back, Shanghai is also a city fundamentally defined by immigrants. Everybody came from somewhere, almost. And Shanghai, as we know, speak a Shanghai dialect. And that's why my daughter's Mandarin is not as good, because both my wife and me come from Shanghai, and we talk at home English and Shanghaiese. We don't speak Mandarin that much. But there are sub-dialects in Shanghai. Most of people in Shanghai speak a certain kind of Shanghai dialect. But the really native Shanghaiese whose family have lived there for hundreds of years, they tend to live in the suburbs around Shanghai, so-called counties. And they spoke a very distinctive sub-dialect of it. And the contradiction is, throughout history, they were often tend to be discriminated against. It was outsiders, and so the immigrants who made fortunes in Shanghai and really, you know, made Shanghai their home. In so doing, their economic power, their social status enabled them to be the social elite of Shanghai. So in large measure, Shanghai is a city of outsiders. That's very different from many other cities in China throughout history, which are lineage-based, family-based. So that's why you go to some villages, countryside in China, often case this is a village of Mr. Lee, village of John, village of Smith. They're all named after surnames. Shanghai was never such a case from the beginning. And also, the contradiction between the Western culture that brought in by immigrants and the native cultures that are also brought by immigrants, those immigrants from neighboring places and the people, the scholars, government officials, well-educated class, fleeing Taiping rebels and so on and so forth, create a very dynamic contradiction and an interaction in both cases. So there are many lens by which we could look at Shanghai, and particularly its visual culture. So what is the organizing principle for our exhibition that we have on view now? And again, this is a kind of a contradiction in a small way, because a lot of people give me the credit, say, Jay, you're a new director and you originally from Shanghai, and your museum is doing a Shanghai show. You must have made it happening. I said, no, actually it's by pure accident. Many of you know for a museum to do a major show, usually takes 4 or 5 years. And you know, I'm here only for 2 years. So when I came to this town, the Shanghai exhibition was already being planned and well into its development. The impetus for the Shanghai exhibition took place even a few years before. As you remember, in 2008, our museum did a Ming Dynasty exhibition. When our curatorial staff was about to finish the planning for the Ming Dynasty, let's say 2005, or even earlier, they talked with the Shanghai Museum's colleague, and the subject of a World Expo came up. And it's very natural. The next project on Chinese side for our museum, maybe we should do a Shanghai exhibition. So in that regard, I was fortunate. I'm very fortunate they'll be able to walk into a new position to have a show about my hometown. So so that's why. So, but in that regard, that what I'm saying about organizing principle is convey what our curatorial team has identified, and the length of identification is for this particular show is trade. As we know, Shanghai opened up as a trading port, as a traumatic beginning, but also because of trade, Shanghai gets to be what it is. It's the most vibrant, dynamic, and also most powerful economic engine for China. And San Francisco and Shanghai had a particular strong connections. I think when the cross-continental railroad link was made, and it was a major help for the cross-Pacific trade. And across Pacific trade, San Francisco occupied a very important position, right? And Shanghai on the other side, Tokyo also on the other side, being the major ports that San Francisco traded with. So when we say Shanghai and San Francisco had 30 years of city relationship, it is true. But the real relationship, I think, has been as long as 150 years. When both Shanghai started as an international city, and San Francisco started out as an international city as well, this mid-19th centuries. Right, so California not only gold rush, but the Asian trade has always been a very important part. So this kind of interaction is very, very important. So our show can largely be divided into four segments. One is the beginning, which explores the international trade. And the second part is called High Time, which is more in the 1930s, which is High Time is itself a contradictory term. High could mean both good and also bad. It's not always good. And so this is why it's a very carefully chosen word, High Time. On the one hand, it was Paris of East, and it was the most exciting city in visual culture in terms of new artistic trends, new literatures being produced. But on the other hand, it has a very rawdiness of it. That's why it was also labeled as the whore of the East. And then look at. And the third part is called revolution, because this is another area that really defines what Shanghai's excitement about. It's always the hotbed of the radical thoughts, sometimes very radical thoughts. You know, one of the major strongholds for the Republic movement, which eventually overthrew the Manchu Qing Empire, Shanghai was it. Shanghai was a major power base. Chiang Kai-shek's most important power base was Shanghai. But also, it was in Shanghai the Chinese Communist Party was established in 1921. So you can tell the radicalness of Shanghai. And some of the artworks, for example, you can see the woodblock prints in our show featuring the early stage of revolution the contrast between haves and have-nots. You have the most luxury mansion, and outside of it, you literally see people dying of starvation there as well. And also we know Shanghai, ever since the beginning, has been, as I mentioned, the hotbed for radical thoughts. And it was also the major place where Cultural Revolution from 1966 to 1976 that taking place. Cultural Revolution was all over China, but Shanghai was one major theater for Cultural Revolution, if you will. And it expressed itself visually through revolutionary posters. Those posters showing people's rally, showing people's demonstrations, and the mass movement, and you can see some of them there in the exhibition as well. No matter how individually our personal feelings about, as a part of history, I think it's important to see these. And on a personal level, that I had also my own personal experience with Cultural Revolution as well, because I was 3 when Cultural Revolution started. I was 13, 10 years later, when it was over. So I was really a small child. So I did not have kind of sufferings that many of older people, my parents' generations, or my senior siblings, they had physical. But as a child, I saw a lot. And only gradually I come to terms with it, because as a small child, often the case, you did not necessarily understand what's happening right in front of you. It takes distance to come to terms, come to understand what was really unfolding. But that experience had become part of me in the sense of, you see, the dramatic destruction, the dramatic human sacrifice, the dramatic victim, the magnitude of a human loss, not only physically but mentally. It was truly, truly very traumatic and also deeply affecting, I will say. It's hard to describe to anyone who you have not been through. Likely for me to understand what World War II was like if I had not living through it. But I think there are maybe sometimes some commonality, because there's many forms of human sufferings, and the Cultural Revolution was certainly one of them. So it is something that very personal in that regard. But on the history of China, it is again reinforced impression of Shanghai being a stronghold, a hotbed for radicalism. But one sensibility of about Shanghainese, I think, which is very positive, is that even in the harsh times such as Cultural Revolution, when China was really closed down, there was very little interaction with the outside world, Shanghai people, often the case, I think, now I'm biased because I came from there, tend to be more curious, more fashion conscious, and more forward-looking, if you will. Everybody was wearing Mao jacket and wearing a Mao hat. But the Shanghainese was often the case, give it a particularly sharp ironing, and give a particular angle of the Mao hat so they would look sharper. Certainly I did that, and many of other people do that too. And there is also a traditional old-time saying about Shanghai ladies. And let me translate, try to translate for you. Say the women in Shanghai did not mind their houses being burned down, but they were worried that they would fall from the bicycle. This is talking about the generation in the 60s, 70s. Why so? Because everyone was poor. There are not much in the house anyway, in the apartment anyway. So it burned down, so what? But they put the best material possessions on their body, their dress, and whatever little jewelry they could still wear, and so on and so forth. So once they fall, they will ruin it. This is something they could not afford. And this tells you, you know, the really daring, forward-looking, the optimistic mentality of Shanghai ladies. They are very fashion conscious, even in very difficult times. But the contradiction, again, about Shanghai is actually once the Cultural Revolution was over, Shanghai was not the first city that to start to open door and reform. Why so? Because Shanghai, even throughout the very difficult times of Cultural Revolution and other political movements, it had always been a pillar of Chinese economy. So the government was very concerned about if you open up Shanghai for experiment, then it could fail, and ultimately it will be disastrous for the whole Chinese economy. That's why they chose Shenzhen, right? A small town across the border from Hong Kong. This is where the Chinese reform started economically, not Shanghai. Shanghai started in the 1990s. But Shanghai, once it started in the 1990s, the speed by which that it transformed itself was literally astounding. There was a saying that the city bird for Shanghai is a crane, but it's not a crane that you see in the zoo. It's a construction crane. It has the largest concentration of construction crane on the face of the earth because of the building speed. Tell you one thing, again, about the visual images, the visual culture. We talk about city, the impression about city very much defined by the urban landscape. Shanghai has a river called the Huangpu, right? So you literally go through, zigzagging through Shanghai, sort of in a north-south way. So you have the west part of city and the east part of the city. It has always been the west part of the land that is really what Shanghai city in a narrow sense meant. East side of river was really the suburb with the rice field. When I grew up in Shanghai, you have only one way to go cross river to the other side of the river, get to the east part. Then you pay 3 cents for a ferry, and the ferry runs back and forth. There was one tunnel, but you normally don't get into the tunnel because it was strategically important. And there was no high-rise whatsoever in Shanghai on the east side of the river at all. And there was a saying at that time, I'd rather have a space, one single bed size on the west side of the city than have a house on the east side of the river. Because nobody wants to live there. There is just no city life, so to speak. But today, if you think of Shanghai, if you look at the World Expo site, the first image you probably see is the sky. It's the skyline of the east side of the city called Pudong. All the new high-rises. They're building the tallest building on the face of Earth, maybe somewhere become the second tallest. The TV tower, the Shanghai tower, and the hotels. The highest building in China nowadays concentrate in the east side of the Huangpu River called Pudong. And they define the skyline. And then you look back. So if you contrast today's Shanghai with 1930s Shanghai, the image of 1930s Shanghai you'll be presented is always you look at the west side of the river from the east. You have the river and you have the skyline of the west town, the west side of the city, with the skylines, Art Deco building and Edwardian and so on and so forth, along the Bund, we call it. But today, the image is the other way around. But both still exist. But this tells you how rapidly China and Shanghai has changed and how visual culture defines what we understand about certain city in this particular case. So I think the speed in the last 20 or so years in Shanghai has been so dramatic that on a personal level, I both feel very happy for the city, and also I have a certain melancholy because, as I mentioned, it's very hard to find where my old neighborhood is anymore. So the fourth part of our exhibition is called Contemporary Shanghai Present. So the first part of exhibition, beginning, the second part, high time, the third part, revolution, and the fourth part is the Shanghai today. And that's the area that the contemporary art is very much being featured in. And this area, again, is a very vibrant topic for debate, whether the environmental protection, the quality of life, and between haves and have-nots, and so on and so forth. And on the artistic side, Shanghai, once again, has become the most exciting place for contemporary art, very experimental contemporary art. This is why our show includes some of them as examples, but they're only as a teaser. As I mentioned, there are any number of ways to look at Shanghai, very different perspective, different lens, and economically, politically. But I think one thread that maybe can go through all of them is the idea of contradiction. But I think contradiction it by itself is not bad. But it does give us a angle by which to understand what Shanghai offers and what Shanghai has suffered. And what Shanghai will become tomorrow, perhaps, in our life. And to me, in particular, as an art historian, I'm following up very much on the contemporary art, as well as I'm interested in the preservation of the tradition and traditional architecture in Shanghai. For example, I think, again, through art and visual culture, we can understand city. And we remember a city most clearly, and not by how much GDP the city produces. Is there your impression of the bone, your impression of the garden, and your impression of Pudong, and what do you see, what do people wear? And whether their dress has a particular sharp ironing or not, as versus people in Beijing, for example. Thank you.
We have a couple of questions. If there are any more, let me know. You are not going to lead a tour to the expo, are you? Are you going to lead a tour? And can I go?
I'm leaving for Shanghai on Friday, but I'm going there as a guest to be taken into expo. I don't think I will have the opportunity to lead a tour because I think it's an expo that will have so many people. You have to, they only identify certain maybe licensed tour guides and can take groups and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm.
There will be a number of San Francisco groups at the expo. I know Chanticleer is going to be performing and they're doing a tour of the surrounding areas, so you could call them. This is an interesting one. How can we get Americans and the American government to view Shanghai and China as a whole as allies rather than adversaries?
A question beyond my ken. I'm not a diplomat, not a politician. But I think this may be, to people to people. Indeed, this question nevertheless lead me to a comment I like to make is about, the cultural diplomacy. I typically tell our staff that I'm fundamentally a beneficiary of ping-pong diplomacy. But actually, most of my staff, when I first time said it, they just blanketed me. Very few people know what ping-pong diplomacy was. That really tells me I'm getting old. 1970s feel like last centuries, right? It was last century, but more than, you know what I mean. But before, any political engagement, economic engagement, it's always art, culture, and sports. This is what people-to-people diplomacy. This is where the area that the museum, such as ours, could play such an important role in forge deeper understanding of ourselves as a platform for cross-cultural people-to-people understanding. This is why I'm so excited and fortunate to be able to work for the museum throughout my professional career. So I think go to Shanghai, to look at, go to China, go to our museum to look at the shows and engage a dialogue. I think this is one way, and I think a fundamentally important way to achieve understanding. And eventually, you know, you have to focus on the common interest with the tolerance of difference, whatever that difference might be, because this is the way it's going to be with any nations, even, you know, between the United States and Great Britain. I mean, there will be differences, right? So I think, but people-to-people understanding and cultural diplomacy is really important.
And this being, you being a museum director, we'll try to finish with an artistically oriented question. Do you see any position that abstract art plays in Shanghai? And do you see people valuing abstract paintings since abstract art is rooted in Western cultures? I think you might be answered by going to the exhibition, yes?
Yeah, indeed, this is a very good question. I think certainly Shanghai has become the few cities in China, the other being Beijing, for example, where you can see the most cutting-edge experimental arts, and not only abstract, performance art, video art, and new media, and it's actually in many ways leading the world. Asia contemporary art has become so strong that it's no longer so-called derivatives. It was really in many ways leading the wave, new art, particularly conceptual art. Part of the reason, because Asia is a very vital ground for politically motivated art, environmentally motivated art, it just has so many issues that you can develop. And artists are among the most acutely sensitive people in terms of major issues facing the world. So on the other hand, I have to disagree with the person who raised questions saying that since abstract art is rooted in the Western cultures, my reaction is yes and no. Actually, I dare to say modernism did not start in the West. It started in China. Do you believe that? You know, the highest form of artistic expression in Chinese art is calligraphy, beautiful writing. Calligraphy is fundamentally an abstract art. And if you start looking at Chinese paintings, for example, ink paintings, the most important features or traits about Chinese paintings or Eastern Asian painting in that sense, is about brushwork, lines. And those lines not only try to describe what the landscape is, for example, but also those lines have their own independent abstract value just being viewed on their own, the beautiful lines. So fundamentally, Chinese art is abstract art. Let me give you one poet in the Tang Dynasty, which was way before, in the 8th centuries. Whether he painted in the way he talked about, I don't know, because we don't have his painting to have anymore. I don't think his painting survived. He said, you know, the wonderful painting that I would paint is that a banana trees in a deep snow. Banana trees grow up literally in the southern part of China. There was no snow. So the contradiction between the two is very charming. And also another artist say, you know, what's the essence about landscape painting? Your Chinese painting is so much about landscape painting. Say, if you want to really photorealism, of course his term is ancient, he did not use the word photorealism, but the meaning is that if you really want a real mountain, you go out there to see for your eyes, for yourself. Why should I paint it for you? What I want to paint is not about real mountains as it looks, appears. What I want to paint to you is a real mountain that how I feel about it. So my painting of a mountain is not going to be superficially real, but it will portray to you what I think the essence of a mountain is. So in that regard, I dare to say that modernism, abstract art, was always and has always been part of Chinese art.
Mm-hmm. Did that answer your question? Well, thank you so much, Jay. We're at the end of our time, and it's been our pleasure to have you speak about the Shanghai and Beyond, Understanding the Power of Art and Visual Culture. And we also want to thank the Asian Art Museum for lending Jay's time to us this evening. And thanks to our audience today. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating its 106th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.